Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. A little over 2 months since the first cases of the COVID-19 coronavirus were detected in Pennsylvania, there is still much we don't know about the virus and a few examples of what we thought we knew that is different. But one constant over the past 60 days plus is that there still are many questions about the virus and the illness it causes. Smart Talk is scheduled about one program every 7 days to answer medical questions. And that's what we'll do today. We're joined on today's program by UPMC Pinnacle Infectious Disease Specialist, Dr. John Goldman, with answers to your questions. Dr. Goldman, always good to have you on the program.
Good to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
And this is the opportunity to ask those questions you have about COVID-19, the coronavirus. And I encourage you to get your calls in early because the phones do get busy during this program. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. You can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Goldman, in the introduction, I mentioned that there are some things that we've learned over the past 2 months, and maybe not some things that, or some things that we thought we knew that have changed a little bit. What do we know now that is different than we thought we knew 2 months ago?
I think as we've gone on, we've gotten a lot more experience with the disease and a lot more experience with the virus. I think we've learned that there are a lot of people who are asymptomatic. There are a lot of people who are probably carriers that are not particularly sick. I think we've learned the effectiveness of social distancing. I think we've learned the effectiveness of masking. And I think that we've learned that we expected this to go down quickly. Some of the most widely quoted models showed that it would peak in mid-April and then rapidly decline. I think we've learned that that's not true, that we've seen more of a plateau than a decline. And I think we confirmed that this disease is a lot worse than the common flu. The current mortality in the United States for confirmed cases is 5 to 6%. In contrast, the flu is 0.1% or so. And even if you assume that there are 5 times to 10 times as many cases, so actual cases of COVID, as cases that we've tested and confirmed, we still have a mortality that is 5 to 10, maybe 20 times the flu. And so I think we've learned that this is a very serious disease. I think we've learned that it is a disease that is much worse than the flu. And I think we've learned that although social distancing works, we didn't have a big surge that overwhelmed our system. It's not going away as quickly as we would like.
Okay, you listed a lot of things there that we could talk about, but just that last thing you said about not going away as we would like. Even if we come up with a vaccine, this virus will continue to live, and people who, okay, and there's no guarantee we will come up with a vaccine, but even if we do, if people choose not to get vaccinated for this, it can continue to spread, correct?
So, first of all, getting a vaccine will make the disease harder to spread. Right now, we've got a population that is, for the most part, not immune. So there are roughly 330 million Americans. There are about 1.2 million confirmed cases. There's somewhere between 10 and 15 million people who are likely to have been infected. When you look at herd immunity, the amount that you need to get a part of percentage of the population that needs to be immune in order to really slow down the virus, it has to be about 230 million. So we're a far we're far away from getting the natural immunity. If you get a vaccine, you'll be able to make a much larger percentage of the population immune, and you will be able to really slow down the virus. My guess is this virus is just simply with us, and that eventually it will. We will either get a vaccine or it will end up infecting enough of the population that most people are immune. If I were to look ahead 20 years, my guess is that this eventually will be an illness that most people get in childhood. They can't distinguish it from another benign viral illness, and will only really recognize it when someone gets it as an adult and gets much sicker. But the vaccine would slow down the virus, make it much harder to spread, put much less strain on our medical system, and save a lot of lives.
And we'll talk more about that in a moment, but you were talking about that herd immunity, and that is an assumption that those who have contracted the disease, the illness, or, you know, have tested positive for it, maybe not gotten sick, that they will be immune afterwards. There seems to be some question now whether that is the case or not.
So right now, it's not clear how much immunity you get or how long it lasts for. So, for example, we have healthcare workers who have had documented disease, and we certainly don't tell them you're immune. You can just, for example, go into a patient with COVID's room and not wear personal protective equipment. They take the same precautions that someone who has not had the disease takes. On the other hand, if you look at previous epidemics, so for example, the flu of 1918, when the flu of 1918 first appeared, we had a very similar kind of outbreak to what we're having now. But as it went through the population and people got immunity, it spread more slowly. And as people had partial immunity, or because they'd exposed to, as people, and they didn't get as sick as the flu kind of went through the population, had what's changed a little bit, had what's called genetic drift. And so when you got it a second time with a slightly different strain and you had pre-existing immunity, cross-immunity, people didn't get as sick. So what you would assume with this virus, and I'll stress here that I just simply left my crystal ball at home today. We don't understand nearly everything about this virus, and we don't understand basic questions like, can you get sick twice with it? But you would assume that people, if they have partial immunity to the virus, would be much less likely to get very sick like they are now. And you'd also assume that even if they only had partial immunity to the virus, it would act more like something like the flu, where the chances of it would spread more slowly and the chances of getting very sick from it would go down.
All right, let's take a phone call from Jim in Lebanon. Jim, you're on the air.
Thank you, Scott. Yes, I have a question for your guest. Now, when I was on the phone talking to the person who answers, the doctor was commenting something about the flu, and I didn't quite hear exactly what he said as I was speaking. So my question was going to be, I was wondering just how effective this staying at home really is in avoiding corona, because I just heard the other night on Laura Ingraham's TV program that one of the states, I forget which one, there were like a few hundred coronavirus deaths, but yet there were a couple thousand deaths from the flu. Now, I would think if staying home is avoiding coronavirus, since it is also an airborne disease, then why are so many people getting the flu? I think they'd be avoiding that as well by staying home, but it doesn't seem to be the case.
So there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that the flu virus came through with a completely different season before we did social distancing. So the flu started in this country this season in late October, early November, and then continued on until March, and then went really dramatically down near the start of April. So people were getting the flu, and people were getting sick from the flu before people really started social distancing. All I can tell you is that with what we have at UPMC Pinnacle, we have people who do modeling of this disease in order to try to predict how it's going to be. And we came to the conclusion that the social distancing decreased the average number of infections per COVID patient. So the average number of people who a single person with COVID in turn infected from about 2.1 to 1.8. Now, initially, that doesn't sound like it's very effective, but if you're having something that decreases the infectiousness exponentially, and that really did slow down the spread of the disease, to put it in perspective, that effect is about the effect equivalent to the effect of giving flu shots in the United States and the effect that it currently has on the flu. So we did clearly slow down the disease. We did clearly prevent the surge. We did clearly prevent, especially in our area, our medical system from getting overwhelmed. What we didn't do is eliminate the disease, and there is still ongoing transmission in central Pennsylvania at a fairly low but fairly constant rate.
Doctor, one of the things that has changed over the past 2 months is what are some of the symptoms that are recognized as being part of the illness. At first, we heard fever, dry cough, shortness of breath. Since then, the CDC has added chills, shaking, muscle pain, headache, a prolonged headache, sore throat, loss of taste and smell, sometimes confusion, sometimes gastrointestinal issues, and something called COVID toes. Now, all of these symptoms don't present, and some of them present very rarely. The one that seems to be the most constant is the fever, and the other one that has become almost a barometer is the loss of taste and smell. So what do you think about those additional symptoms that have been added, because many of those symptoms could be the flu or another illness?
So first of all, the presentation of COVID is incredibly vague. So first of all, 80% of the patients who get COVID have relatively minor symptoms. And I've actually had people who say, look, here are my symptoms. Sounds like the common cold. I don't have a fever. A week later, we test them, and they turn out to be COVID. In contrast, the positive testing rate at most of our testing sites is about 10%. So people who have pretty good stories for COVID, only about 1 out of 10 of them have the disease. The problem is that it's very hard to distinguish clinically someone who has COVID from someone who has the flu, from someone who has another version of the common cold, from someone who has any of the other respiratory viruses. Now, there are some things. The loss of taste and the loss of the sense of smell probably are a better indicator of COVID. When you have them, you're probably more likely to have COVID. On the other hand, most patients with COVID don't get these symptoms. A lot has been written about COVID toe, and that tends to occur more in young, healthy people. And so, but again, you probably are more likely to have COVID if you suddenly have these changes to your toes. They get red, they get tender, they get swollen. But most people with COVID also don't develop those symptoms. And there's even now a COVID inflammatory syndrome that presents in young children that looks like an old disease called Kawasaki's disease, where it causes inflammation of the large arteries. And so there's now some speculation that COVID can cause this inflammatory artery syndrome in kids. One of the things we're finding is COVID attacks many more systems than just the lungs. So there's just this morning a paper in the American Cardiology that suggests when people get COVID, their blood clots more easily than usual, and is suggesting that we probably should be using blood thinners in severe cases. There's suggestions that it attacks the kidney more frequently, and there's suggestions that people with COVID are going to have a lot wider range of symptoms and have a lot more organs infected than just the lungs.
Wow. It's just, this illness is, I don't know, you're in a better position with your knowledge and things you've seen, but the more we learn about it, the more devastating it becomes with, as you said, 1 out of 10 that test positive still, but with organs being impacted and all that. We'll be back with Dr. Goldman in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Dr. John Goldman, an infectious disease specialist at UPMC Pinnacle. And yes, as you just heard, UPMC Pinnacle is a financial supporter of WITF Smart Talk. This is your opportunity to ask questions about COVID-19, the coronavirus. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532, and we'll get to as many as we can. Let's go to the phone now. Walter is on the line. Walter, what's your question for Dr. Goldman?
Well, since so much of the damage and difficulty seems to be related to inflammation, in the lungs, for example, they think the inflammation comes from an overreaction of the immune system. I had heard a doctor who tried giving steroids to help, and from what the report said, he had some limited success. Now, steroids also depress the immune system, so my question is, has the doctor heard any more about that, or has he any thoughts about administering an anti-inflammatory? In my case, it would be Cumacin, which is a powerful anti-inflammatory, which comes from turmeric to help with this inflammation.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Goldman, what do you think?
I think that's an extremely good question, and I'm not going to be able to give an extremely good answer. There is a lot of thought. Could this be an overreaction of the immune system? Yeah. And, for example, one of the things that patients that get very sick is there's a so-called cytokine storm. Your immune system overreacts so badly that it's really the immune system doing the disease. We actually have ongoing studies of whether or not giving prednisone helps. They're dueling recommendations, One of the big sepsis guidelines recommends against it, giving steroids. And that's because in the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, a similar coronavirus from about 10 years ago, when they gave steroids, they actually worsened, prolonged the disease and had a higher mortality. And then I believe it's the American Society of Critical Care has recommended trying to use steroids. So people are on the basis that they think it may help prevent the overreaction of the immune system. We're waiting on good controlled trials, meaning we're waiting on trials to figure out whether or not those really work. One of the big difficulties in treating this disease is, you know, we've been studying influenza for 200 years. With this, we've been studying it for 5 months, and so many of us are in the position of having to try to treat patients with incomplete data. So we try to treat patients, and we have to think about things like, do you try using steroids when you really don't have a study where it's an idea, where it's a theory that it might help, but you don't have a study that says it will? There even, one of the drugs we have given is something called tocilizumab, which is an IL-6 inhibitor. IL-6 is one of the immune modulators. And in people who have cytokine storm, we try to give tocilizumab to see whether to try to block IL-6 and stop that cytokine storm. We've had some success with it, but it's not clear whether or not it's really working. And so we're in the position of trying therapies without knowing whether or not they really work. We don't have the studies that compare those therapies to a placebo. And so we're put in the position of sometimes giving things we think might work but we're not sure that they do, and we're not sure that they don't cause harm.
Well, and I think, Dr. Goldman, this is probably a good opportunity to tell listeners to not try these things, since we've had a lot of different people, including the president, who has made some suggestions of some things that may work, and people have gone out and done it. And, you know, this is something to leave to the medical professionals like yourself.
Well, and also leave it until we have answers. So the Infectious Disease Society of America, for example, recommends not treating anyone with COVID outside of a trial. There are a lot of things that are being thrown about that may prevent it. What I recommend to people is kind of everything your mother told you. Sleep, taking care of yourself. There appears to be an association with smoking and worse mortality, so not starting smoking or trying to cut back if you do smoke. I wouldn't try home remedies, and I wouldn't start taking anything without talking to your doctor first.
Saw an article this morning, Dr. Goldman, that said that 89% of those who have died from COVID-19 had a pre-existing condition. And looking down through those pre-existing conditions, half of them had hypertension, 48% were obese, 28% had diabetes, 28% had a cardiovascular disease, 17% had asthma, 11% COPD. What do you think about those statistics?
So there are two things that clearly affect COVID mortality. One is age. So people across the world, in several of the outbreaks, mortality was 0.2 to 0.4% below the age of 50, 1 to 2% from 50 to 60, 3 to 4% from 60 to 70, 7 to 8%, 70 to 80, and then 10 to 15% above the age of 80. So it's one of these diseases that if you are older, you are clearly more likely to get sick. In addition, having other medical conditions clearly increased your risk of getting severe disease. It's unusual for someone with no medical conditions to get very sick. And if you have diabetes, heart disease, and hypertension, your chances of getting very sick go up if you get the disease. With that said, we have had people who are young, who have had no other real medical conditions, who have ended up in our intensive care unit, have ended up dying. And so one of the things that is so frightening about this disease is that there's an element of randomness. We know that you're more likely to get sick if you're older. You're more likely to get very sick if you have multiple conditions. But being young and healthy doesn't always protect you.
Let's take a call from Jim in Edders. Jim, you're on the air.
Good morning. Bear with me. I have two questions, and one is topical to what he was just talking about. If you have hypertension, but it's been well controlled for 15 years, and in fact, I'm 68, the drug I'm on is Losartan, and it's been shown in a couple of studies to be beneficial to prevent COVID because of the receptors it works with. Are you still at high risk just because that's an underlying condition, even though it's been well controlled for 15 years?
You're probably at higher risk. You're probably not at much higher risk if it's well controlled. And there was initially some controversy over whether, because ACE inhibitors and ARBs, angiotensin receptor blockers, upgrade the number of receptors you have, whether they might increase your mortality with COVID. It seems actually they do the opposite, that they probably make you less likely to get sick. I am not stopping any of my patients who are on ACEs or ARBs from taking them. I'm continuing them. I'm also not putting people on it just to try to see if it prevents them from getting COVID, and we certainly aren't using them as a treatment of COVID.
Somebody must be, because I had trouble getting my prescription last time that they were all out of it. My second question, this is somewhat hypothetical, but my wife about 10 to 12 days ago had a scratchy throat, and I would call it a head cold, but no fever. But then she got chills for about an hour. So let's assume that she had a mild case of COVID. How long is she shedding disease after that?
And how so that's an extremely good question that, again, I have to give a kind of vague answer to. So the when they ask how long someone should be quarantined, it would be 10 days. So they assume that you be 10 days, and you have to have had no fevers for 3 days and an improving cough. And if you follow what's called the no testing strategy for getting people off of isolation, you do it after 10 days with improving symptoms. On the other hand, when we look at hospitalized patients and then test them for COVID, typically they stop shedding the virus. They stop being positive by PCR, by the nasal test, after about 2 to 3 weeks, but can remain positive for up to 6 weeks. It's further complicated by we don't know if the people who are shedding, who are PCR positive, who have the positive nasal swab, we can find that viral DNA in their nose, if they're infectious. And there are other studies that look, if you can culture the virus, and the people who try to culture the virus seem to find that it goes away after about 10 days to 2 weeks. But that's one of the many things we don't quite understand yet. Clearly, it seems as if people who have mild disease probably remain infectious for less time, and people who have severe disease probably remain infectious longer, but no one has really been able to define this yet.
Yeah, Dr. Goldman, we are getting a lot of questions about that quarantine period and the amount of time that people are contagious. James has a question, and I think that this is a timely one because of Mother's Day this weekend. James asks, he says, I have several immunocompromised loved ones. If I'm asymptomatic, how long do I have to stay away from them?
You know, that's a very good question. And what I would tell you is that while there's ongoing transmission in our area, that it's probably a good idea to stay away from them. If you do see them, wear a mask. Or what I've had a number of people do is they go and see their older parents, and they stay outside. They stay 6 feet apart, and so that if there is any transmission, if there is someone is infected and they're asymptomatic, they don't accidentally give it to them. I actually haven't seen my own parents face-to-face for weeks because I don't want to take, especially since I'm going to the hospital, I don't want to take a chance of accidentally infecting them. So I would advise that if they're older, if they're immune compromised, to do really good social distancing. If you have any symptoms whatsoever, stay away. And if you do see them, try to wear a mask and try to do it outside and try to stay more than 6 feet apart.
Now, you had said earlier that age is one of the risk factors. If you're talking about your mother, for example, that is over the age of 70, for example, is it, even if no one is showing any symptoms and even if they go through the social distancing and everything you just listed, does it make sense to go see your mom on Sunday?
In that age group, I would say no. So, again, that age group has, from 70 to 80, has a 6 to 7% mortality. Above the age of 80 has a 10 to 15% mortality. And this is a judgment call that people have to make for themselves. But I am not comfortable with possibly infecting someone that is at such high risk of getting very sick.
A question from Ann says when we're talking about 1 in 10 testing positive, does that take into account the false negatives? How often does that occur?
That's a great question. And the problem that we have is because this is so new, we don't know. My experience, now there's one very small paper out of China that suggests that the test is about 70% sensitive. If you take 100 infected people, it'll be positive 70% of the time. And that if you wait from the first to the second rate, that goes up. The problem that we have is we don't have a good idea of what the false negative rate is because we don't have a gold standard. We don't have a source of truth that tells us this is the patient who is really infected that we can compare the test to. My experience has been that I think it's pretty accurate because we get people who someone says, we've tested them, they're negative, this must be COVID. And we've done a number of those that have been retested. They usually aren't positive. It's relatively rare to have a second test come back as positive. A first test negative and a second positive. We have had cases where the husband has been positive, the wife has been negative, and we assume that's a false negative. We have had one or two people who, when they're tested a week to 2 weeks later, are positive. But we're doing a lot of testing, and we're not usually finding a negative than a positive test. So my guess is the test is pretty good, but I can't quote a number on what the false negative, the false positive, the false negative rate is. I can't tell you how often the test misses disease.
I have a question here that a listener just wanted to clarify something that said earlier. It says the virus is spread by people. It's not just floating in the air, correct? It's not airborne.
Well, the virus is airborne, so that's why we talk about the 6 feet. And one of the things we're still people are still studying is how far it can travel. But most people say that it's like the flu and like other viruses, that if you cough or sneeze, it can get into the air and you can become infected. The other issue is most people think that, like the flu, if it lands on a surface, it can live on that surface for a number of hours. If you touch that surface and then touch your face, you can infect yourself. And that's one of the reasons we put such emphasis on good hand washing. That's one of the reasons we put emphasis on doing things like sneezing into your sleeve, not into your hand. And again, as we get more information about the virus, we'll understand a lot more. This is one of the things that we're in the process of understanding.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Dr. John Goldman, an infectious specialist, disease specialist at UPMC Pinnacle. We have about 20 minutes left in the program. If you would like to ask a question of Dr. Goldman about COVID-19, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. You've touched on this one, I think, Dr. Goldman, but again, we've been getting a lot of questions about this. How long is someone asymptomatic?
So it's not clear how long someone is asymptomatic. For the purposes of investigating COVID, we assume that someone is infectious approximately 2 weeks, or 48 hours before they show up with symptoms. But there are presumably people who are have mild or asymptomatic disease. We assume that they probably are infectious for the same 7 to 10 days that someone who has disease is infectious. But it's, again, something we really don't know. One of the real worries and one of the real reasons that this is such a hard disease to control is we do think that there are a group of people out there who are asymptomatic, are able to spread the disease. And what you worry about is, you know, if you have a bunch of kids, younger people are almost certainly likely to be asymptomatic. And what you worry about is that they will then accidentally spread it to people of higher risk. But we don't know if you're asymptomatic how long you stay infectious for. It's probably 7 to 10 days.
Had a question here about, do we know any more about how effective masks are?
So what we do know is that masks seem to work. We have some objective data. I saw something that Austria actually required masking and immediately cut its rate of infection by 90%. at the Brigham Hospital in Boston, where they have many, many more COVID cases than we were. We're getting about 20 healthcare workers infected per day. They cut the they required universal masking, and they cut it to about 5 a day, so they cut their infection rate among healthcare workers by 75%. I personally think masks are very effective. I think the surgical masks are most effective. And all I can tell you is that at UPMC Pinnacle, the hospital, because we are all masked and we're all screened, is very safe. I actually feel safer in the hospital than I do if I'm, you know, have to go to the grocery store, because everyone is masked. Because since we've been masking everyone, we've seen no transmission to patients, and we've seen very little transmission either from patients to healthcare workers or from healthcare workers to each other. What we found originally was, before everyone was masked, we had to worry as much about provider to provider transmission. With masking, we basically eliminated that. So I can't quote studies. I can just tell you that from our personal appearance, our personal experience, masks seem to be really effective, and I think it's one of the reasons that the hospital is so safe right now.
And just to clarify, a mask will not keep you from contracting the virus, but it will keep you from spreading it to someone else.
A cloth mask will keep you from spreading it to someone else. A surgical mask will both keep you from spreading it and keep you from contracting it.
All right. You know, one of the things that we have learned over the past 2 months, but especially we've heard this mentioned in the last couple of weeks, is that it appears that sunlight, that heat does, and humidity does have an impact on how long the virus can live on surfaces. If you're indoors, it doesn't matter. But outdoors, it seems to, if there's direct sunlight and some heat and some humidity, the combination, that it lives longer on some surfaces. We have a question here from Sarah. Says, I've been told that if I put my mask out in the sun, that will kill the coronavirus germs. So I put my paper mask on the dashboard of the car after I use it to sit in the sun. Does this work? So can I reuse it? And would it work with a cloth mask as well?
It should work. Now, the guidelines for using a paper mask are that you can continue to use them until they look soiled. So, for example, the hospital offers me a mask every morning, and I typically use mine for 2, 3, 4 days because I know that the masks are in shortage and I want to conserve them. Putting it on the dashboard of the car where it's going to get hot is likely to help. One of the big controversies with masks is, how do we safely sterilize them? And UPMC Pinnacle is actually going to be recycling some of its masks through a process that we know works. But certainly putting it on the dashboard of the car is likely to help, not likely to hurt.
Just want to clarify here, when we're talking about UV rays from the sun, that does not mean that if you go out in the sun, get yourself a sunburn, that you're immune from COVID-19. It just means that the combination of heat, humidity, certain cases, that will kill it. I don't know if kill it is the right word, but it doesn't live on a surface as long.
So what we're hoping is that as it gets warmer and hotter, the virus will be slowed down. One of the reasons that cold and flu season occurs is that the virus does better, lives longer, the cold and flu viruses, in colder, less humid weather. On the other hand, with COVID-19, there are places in the world that have active outbreaks that are tropical. And so we think that summer months will slow it down, but won't, but probably are not going to make it go away. So what we worry about is, what we hope is, that the summer, people will get out more, they won't be as close together, the virus won't be able to transmit itself as well. And what you worry about is that when it gets colder in the fall, it will come back a little bit, the so-called second wave. But you can't just simply go out in the sun and sterilize yourself and prevent yourself from getting the disease.
Let's take a phone call from Tony. Tony, you're on the air.
Morning. One question, just let me preface that by mentioning that I find the doctor's explanations generally very helpful, including his clarifying what isn't yet fully clear and isn't fully known. Hopefully it counters some of these simplistic solutions and actually home remedy type talk of home remedies that might actually make coronavirus that might be useless against it. My question is has to do with my son-in-law. He's a part of a work crew that does both inside and outside work with old HVAC systems. He was told a couple days ago by the boss, as was everyone else on his work crew, to go home. They wouldn't be called back into work for at least 15 days because it was found that an individual who was part of the crew, who they worked with, had been suspected of contracting COVID-19. The minimum time that he was told he'd have to be home was 15 days. To the doctor, does that sound about right?
That
before
does.
The individual was tested, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that does sound about right. The incubation period of COVID is supposed to be up to 2 weeks. On average, people get sick 4 to 5 days after they're exposed. But they, after 2 weeks, if they haven't gotten sick, they will not have gotten the disease. And what we very standardly do if someone is exposed is we tell them to go home so they don't get sick at work and expose more people at work. So the two-week period is very standard. It seems very unlikely that if someone was exposed to COVID, has not gotten sick by 2 weeks, that they will get COVID from that exposure.
Thank you very much for your call. Let's take another call now from Dan in Akron. Dan, you're on the air.
Hello. My main question was, I'm a 65-year-old gentleman who's retired. I work part-time for a nonprofit, 20 hours a week. I keep my travels to a minimum. I walk 4.5 miles a day. I'm in good shape, but I'm on hypertension medication. Does that medication preclude me from being one of the groups that are majorly affected by this? Does that help me at all, or should I be thinking that I shouldn't be going out at all because I have hypertension?
So in the 65-year-old age group, if you are on hypertension, it's a slight risk. You're still in the age group where you could get sick. You're not at high risk. And if high blood pressure is your only other medical condition, it's much less likely that you would get sick. It's possible that if you're on one of the hypertensive medications called an ACE inhibitor or an angiotensin receptor blocker, an ARB, that may actually be protective. My personal belief, and this isn't really backed up by a lot of good data, is if you are healthy enough to walk 4 miles a day, I'd strongly encourage keeping doing that, and that probably makes there is some evidence that that gives a boost to your immune system and some evidence that that may prevent you from getting sicker.
Dr. Okay, Goldman, go ahead.
I have a follow-up question. Yeah, sure. I also have a beard, and the New York Times the other day said a pandemic is not the time to grow a beard because the N95 mask won't work. I heard you say a minute ago that N95 will help prevent you from getting it, but will prevent somebody else from getting it. And a cloth mask will just prevent somebody else from getting it from you. Is there a way I can double up on a cloth mask? Because the N95 just won't work for me, and I have about 10 of them.
Yeah. Quick question. How long is your beard?
Oh, my Lord. I'm Santa Claus.
Okay. All right. Okay. I was just trying to picture it.
So let me clarify my terms.
Quite long.
There are three types of masks. A cloth mask, a surgical mask, and an N95 mask. The N95 masks have to be fit tested. We have to make sure no air gets in. The surgical masks do not have to be.
Okay.
If you have a large beard, you could still use a surgical mask without worrying about its fit. I do know a lot of healthcare providers who had beards and the ones that are clearly have to wear N95 masks and are because they're exposed to COVID patients have often shaved the beards. On the other hand, for you, you're not getting direct exposure, and you could use a surgical mask as opposed to an N95 with a beard.
Okay, so thank you very much for your call. Dr. Goldman, right now, from what I understand, there are about 100 different trials going on around the world for a vaccine or for some type of medication to treat COVID-19. Normally, a vaccine takes years to develop. And we've been hearing anywhere from 12 to 18 months, maybe even 6 months. What's happening that we could, I mean, again, there's no guarantee that we can come up with a vaccine, but what's happening that it could happen that quickly?
So a couple of things are happening. First of all, there are many more trials of a COVID vaccine than there are, for example, of a new flu vaccine or a chickenpox vaccine. Typically, you have one or two companies doing work on it, and that obviously, if you have one or two vaccines, or even a half dozen, it's less likely that one will succeed if you have 100. In addition, there's some that were pre-made. They had been people studying vaccines for coronavirus because of some of the previous, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Virus Syndrome and the severe acute respiratory syndrome virus, which are both coronaviruses. So some of those were pre-made. And also they're shortening the time span. They're trying to go from animal testing to human testing more quickly. And 6 months, I think, I hope they could do it in 6 months. That seems quick to me. I think realistically a year and a half, 2 years. By the same token, I'm not a vaccine expert. So I hope we get lucky and one of them works out and we have it available much sooner than we think.
One of our listeners reminded me that we had a researcher from UPMC at Pittsburgh on the program earlier, just a few weeks ago, that they are working on, because just as you had described, they were working on a possible vaccine because they had some things in place for SARS and MERS, as you had described. As being part of the UPMC system, do you get any updates on that?
We've gotten updates that they released it. They're applied to the FDA to start human trials, and they hope to be starting those trials in the fall, I believe.
Okay, let's see. We have a few other questions here. Let's see. Oh, as far as testing, have the tests improved?
So the testing has improved mainly because it is much more available. If you go back to February and March, it was only available through the Department of Health. It's now available through commercial labs. And so we've increased our capacity 10 to 100-fold. What I would caution is that the capacity, the need for testing, goes up in an almost unlimited manner. We have greatly increased our capacity. We need to be able to test more and more people. And I do think that in terms of getting the country back to normal, being able to test people frequently and rule out the disease will be one of the key parts of that.
You know, and you, when you talk about getting the country back to normal, right now there are many people who want to try to get back to normal. And I actually had a listener who said earlier, you said that we've kind of flattened the curve somewhat, so why aren't we getting back to normal? What would you say right now? And unfortunately, this has become a political issue for many people, but as a scientist, as an infectious disease specialist, what do you say about those people who are chomping at the bit to get back to normal?
So I think that we have to do it very carefully, because I think there is tremendous economic cost, a tremendous economic pain to the amount of social distancing that we've had. On the other hand, it gave us time to get the testing going. It gave us time to get adequate personal protective equipment. It kept us from overwhelming our medical system. And as I think as we loosen that back up, we will see an increase in cases. So we have to loosen things back up carefully. I think that we're all going to be wearing masks for quite a long time. I think that we're all going to have to be avoiding large crowds for quite a long time. And I think that we are going to have to be careful for quite a long time. So I actually am very much in favor of opening, of relaxing these restrictions, but doing it carefully,
doing it slowly and being prepared to cut back if we see a big spike in cases. The last thing we want to do is open things up too quickly, see a huge spike in cases, and have to go back to what we have now. But I'm very much in favor of, you know, for example,
Dr. Goldman, I have to interrupt. Hey, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.